The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. So let's get through our announcements so we can start talking with Michael Listener. For those of you who would like to call us and talk with Michael today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So please remember there are no call screeners. Be patient, let the phone ring, and we will answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Please also remember we have only one toll-free line, so if it's busy, that's because somebody is using it. If you think you've waited too long, send me an email to Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, and tell me you're waiting to get in on the phone line, and I'll move our caller right along. And in addition, we take calls over the break and keep you on hold, and we will often hold you over a break if your call is relevant, or we may not take a break until you finish your call. So don't let an upcoming break stop you from giving us a phone call. And again, it is 1-866-687-7223, and then you can reach us also with email, which is Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, or you can reach us through our blog. So to do that, go to our website, and that's thespaceshow.com, all the way to the right to upcoming show menu, and we're the first program for that, and then open it up. That is our archive page, and comments are down at the bottom. Remember, you do not have to be logged in to make a comment or to send us a question. The Space Show detailed website newsletter will be available shortly after this program ends today, and it has all of the information for the coming week in some detail, but it also has the coming events schedule, and we're booking programs right now into August and September of this year. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily download the show. If you actually want a newsletter delivered to your email box, then send me your email address, and our short email newsletter goes out at 6 a.m. California time Monday morning, and you should be receiving that the next Monday after you signed up for it. It is free of charge. So you can easily download shows too, and you can share them, and we certainly invite you to do that. There is a menu on our website, upper left, and so we have a store. It's under support. And if you're interested in T-shirts, coffee cups, you know, things of that nature with the Space Show logo on it, that is where you will find them. So do check that out. There is also an item in that upper left menu for Listen Live. So if you need information on how you listen to a live show or an archive show, or you want to share that information with someone, that is the link that has all the information on it. So again, upper left menu, Listen Live. To me, the most important button is center right on our homepage for supporting the Space Show. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and we're able to bring you this programming because many of you do financially contribute to the Space Show. So remember, as a 501c3 nonprofit, your gift on the federal tax side, if you pay federal taxes, is tax deductible. The same is true if you pay California taxes, as in California we're known as a public benefit corporation. Our parent is onegiantleapfoundation.org. If you have any questions, go to that link, and you can also email me, drspace thespaceshow.com. Please remember you are free to download and share our programs. And there's just a couple of rules about doing that. So one is don't do anything commercial with our programs. And number two, no edits, cuts, or clips. Nothing up on YouTube or any other station or website that you may want to post an edited comment on. And then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And we appreciate your following those guidelines. We do have a statement at the bottom of every one of our spaceshow.com pages regarding our copyright. The same is true for One Giant Leap Foundation. Check it out. And if you have questions, please don't hesitate to ask me. We also have sponsors, and you can see their corporate sponsor messages going across our homepage. Please check them out from time to time. And we appreciate that. The sponsors do change their messages from time to time. So stay current, and if we didn't have our sponsor messages, you would not be getting the Space Show. So they're a very important part of our support network. For the first segment of today, Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor. Excuse me, they're the detailed 100-year forecast for our future in space. And this includes Earth to orbit, reusable in space transportation, also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. Their plan is available for you to see in detail at thespaceplan.com. And when you look at the online plan, they have 500 elements or cells in their plan. And if you click on them, they all expand, and you get a lot more information. If you buy the Integrated Space Plan poster, it is obviously not interactive, but all of the information is there. It's a huge color poster, and it's very inspiring. And again, you can get all of this at thespaceplan.com. Remember, for those of you going to ISDC in St. Louis in a couple of weeks, they are unveiling their new space plan. They've made some changes and revised. I think it's a Saturday presentation, but check your agenda for that. And if you attend, I want to hear back from you on the Space Show. Let us know about what you think and everything. The Space Foundation is another sponsor, and as you know, I just returned from their 33rd symposium in Colorado Springs, which was really outstanding. The 34th symposium is already scheduled, April 16th through the 19th, 2018, again at the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs. I would urge you to go if you've never been. It is certainly an experience worthwhile, and all I can say is go for it. You'll have networking that is very different from any other space type of conference and probably very valuable for us. So Michael Listener is our guest again today. So those of you who listen to many Space Show programs are all very familiar with Michael. He is a space law attorney, and he has an incredible newsletter that we've been talking about all the time since he has published it, called The Pressies, and Michael can tell you more about that. His full bio is on the website, and you can read about him and about his legal background and some of his accomplishments. But we're going to talk to Michael rather than read about him, but do go to our website, and for today's show, you can see his name there, and if you click on his name in upcoming shows, that takes you to the bio page for the guest. So check it out. And Michael, welcome back to the show. How you doing?
Very good. Thank you, Davis. Good to be back.
Is space policy, space legal activities, are they starting to kind of slow down and get mundane and boring for 2017, or are they barnstorming along?
No, things are still pretty warm, and they're moving pretty steadily along, accelerating in some areas. We have issues that pop up that become hot for a little while, then simmer down a little bit, and other issues. So there are issues that pop up and become hot and then cool down a little bit. But when that happens, usually another issue pops up and becomes hot and cools down a little bit. So it's not something that is becoming dormant in any way in 2017, and I expect things will be chugging along at a pretty steady head of steam for the rest of the year.
What's hot as of today's show?
What's hot? Well, I think space, the whole space resources issue is definitely very hot. It was discussed. There was a meeting of the legal 56 legal subcommittee at the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space back in April, and space resources, the theory of space resources, landed on the agenda for the first time. And I haven't digested the complete transcripts and some summations of the that meeting, but it was definitely a very hot topic, and it was very controversial. There were a lot of countries who looked at this very skeptically, and so to the extent that people would say, well, you know, this is settled law, it isn't settled law. There is still a lot of skepticism out there among some countries.
So are we talking about skepticism about the legal right for a company to mine in space? Or are we talking about skepticism because this may be a commercially wacky idea?
No, more or less about the legal right to do it. And a lot of that, you know, this idea was spearheaded in the 2015 Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act, where this concept was introduced by the United States, and other countries like Luxembourg likely has been, you know, pretty hot on this. In fact, their version of a parliament or a legislator over there has been really looking at their version of a space resources law and actually been scrutinizing it pretty heavily. I'm looking at the opinion letter. It's all in French. I got to really find a good English translation so I can really digest what they said. But the bottom line is they're looking at this and saying, you know what, we're not completely sure about this idea of space resources, and we have some more work to do on it to really decide whether or not, you know, the way we're approaching this will actually give a legal right for our citizens to perform this activity in outer space.
Is there anyone in the U.S. legally of any, I don't know, any merit, I use that word, it's probably not the right word, that opposes and says there is no legal right to do this and the company should not be doing it? Does anyone on our side of the Atlantic think that way?
I mean, there are a lot of lawyers, you know, who are looking at this and, you know, who are a little bit skeptical about it. I mean, if you look, when I really look at it, I think there's really a 50-50 split about, you know, whether or not the Outer Space Treaty really grants a legal right to harvest resources. And really to understand the split, you have to look at what's at the root of the issue, and the core issue of this. And that resides in Article 2, which basically says, you know, no sovereign nation can actually appropriate any celestial body. So now one of the agreed things in that little line there is that any appropriation by a nation also includes no appropriation by private individuals. However, the key to space resources is this. The Outer Space Treaty. Now, that phrase in Article 2 is very silent about resources, and people like to stick that out saying, well, you say you can't mine out there. And I come, you know, sometimes just a spark a little argument saying, yeah, but it doesn't say it can either. So there's silence about that. And the decision, and basically how to interpret that silence basically is the turning point of whether or not space resources can be harvested. Now, how does this boil down to? Well, there is one group of thought that said all that resources are, in order for, in that Article 2 prohibition, resources on a celestial body, including water, regolith, minerals, what have you, are considered part of the celestial body. So, in other words, under that theory, that the prohibition applies both to nations and private individuals, and you can't harvest it. What's controversial is that basically what U.S. law looks at it is they interpret Outer Space, Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty to say, okay, we can't appropriate a celestial body. However, the resources aren't part of that prohibition. In other words, they're not part of the celestial body for the purposes of space resources. So that means they can actually go in and private individuals can go there and actually harvest those resources. Now, I talk to people about space resources, and I find out more in when people are talking about it, whether the media or such, they don't really understand how this works. So if you'll indulge me just for a few minutes, I'll try and explain how the whole idea of space resources works, and we'll try and keep it short and brief and pretty succinct. We've all heard this thing about this analogy of harvesting fish from the ocean as comparing it to harvesting space resources. The idea is, you know, the Outer Space Treaty has that Roman property right called res communis. Well, as it turns out, the open ocean on the seas as well also has is also considered, quote, res communis. However, boats can go out and fish in the ocean and collect fish and keep and convert them to their own property. So what people are said, what the theory is, since outer space and celestial bodies are res communis, we can a private individual can go out to these celestial bodies, and through the activity of actually extracting the resource, they can actually turn them to their own personal possession. So it really, and this spins on the head because a lot of people call this mining, but technically this isn't mining because there are two different standards for, say, property law here, say, in the United States versus property law in a no man's land like, say, the ocean or outer space, for example. Here on the land, we have this thing called use, and use is very prominent in Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty, and people really, really harp on that. This is use. Well, a state like Louisiana, for example, which has the Napoleonic Code as formation of its law. Basically, use down there is a property right. It's actually a physical property right in land. And uses can be described as, say, I'm leasing a house or an apartment. I don't own it, but I have the right to use it, to occupy it, you know, to take care of it. But I can't convert it or sell it to anybody else because I don't have that right. I have a property right. However, under Louisiana law, there's this thing called a usufruct. And what a usufruct is, it's basically a right to go onto a land of another and actually harvest resources from it and convert it into my own personal possession. And I like to use the analogy of when I was a teenager, I work on a cattle farm in my town. My boss was a pilot with American Airlines, and his hobby was raising polled Herefords. Well, every summer we had this big operation where we'd go out and we would do haying, but to stock up the barn for the winter. The problem was he didn't have any property of his own that he got the hay from, but he made arrangements with different farms around the area to go in and harvest the hay from their field to bale it and convert it to his use. So, in other words, he was, in a sense, if you want to apply the Napoleonic concept of a usufruct and the way the Louisiana uses it, he had a usufruct or a property interest to go onto the land of the others and harvest that hay and convert it to its own use. But in that case, it was his cattle. He didn't really sell it or anything. Now, in international law, use is considered an activity. It's not a property right. It's an activity. However, in the process of use, let's say we're going out to our celestial body, say an asteroid, and we're going to mine resources. The company goes in, they land on the asteroid, and they start harvesting the resources. Essentially what the law, the U.S. law does, and what the Luxembourg law does, is it creates that same idea of a usufruct, except in this case, the usufruct and use is not a property right, but it's an activity that's permitted that allows those companies to go in and acquire a property right in those resources. So, to recap, in national law, use or usufruct is a property right. In international law, a usufruct is an activity. In the national context, that property right allows you to perform an activity to gain possession over the property right to begin with to actually gain whether it's minerals, hay, or whatever in outer space or in any res communis type of atmosphere. Basically, a use or usufruct, as decided in Article 1, is basically an activity that allows you to create a property interest. So it's kind of a dance versus domestic law, which is kind of a positive attitude, positive type of structure where government guarantees a property interest, versus international law where it's more or less a natural right type of theory is applied to actually obtain possession to these articles, whether it's fish or whether it's resources or whatever. So that's kind of a quick and dirty summation of what how space resources works.
All right. So, excuse me. To get to the bottom line here, you got part of the legal community that doesn't think the treaty allows for any kind of resource usage at all, even by private mm-hmm. companies. And the other half roughly says that they can go out and do it. And, you know, it's unlikely they're going to convince each other, just like Dems aren't going to convince Republicans to vote for them and vice versa. So it's polarized. So how do you see the companies behaving? I know of three companies that are interested in deep space mining. How are they proceeding on this? I think all three of them are American. And what is likely to happen? And if a European country or an Asian country says, hey, you don't have that right, we're going to stop you, what's their recourse to stop a company from doing this?
Well, at this point, you know, my assertion has been this law is mainly a theory at this point, but it gives them some sort of legal foundation to build from, and it'll help them to, you know, continue developing their technology and gain more capital in order to further fund their technology, while at the same time trying to develop the idea in the international community. So my point on my guess on this is going to be a long term thing. Probably it's going to be at least a few more years before this really solidifies. But the idea is this: and I've told this to the media and other people, until a U.S. company actually goes out and recovers resources from outer space, this whole idea of space resources probably won't gain standing as international law. Because you got to understand, you also have that moon agreement sitting out there. I mean, I think 17 nations have ratified it, and that's a small amount, but it's still sitting out there. And you have countries like Russia who are very skeptical, to say the least, of the idea of space resources, and they're kind of pushing back a little bit on the whole idea. But then you have countries like China who are sitting on the sidelines and watching it. So where this goes, it's probably long-term. They actually may become the accepted norm, an accepted customary norm or customary international law. But in the meantime, there's always a possibility the Moon Treaty people, countries aren't going to back down, and they're going to push probably against it.
So, in that instance, what forums exist for litigation, or is it a bunch of diplomatic protest, and that's the opposition to it?
Yeah, there's probably not going to be any litigation on it per se. There's going to be a lot going on in the UN about it, especially with cop use. It's definitely going to be on the agenda for future meetings of the legal and technical subcommittee. So I think you're going to keep on seeing this play out. You're going to see more of a narrative that they're saying, well, this is, you know, this is the wave of the future, and this is going to be accepted international law. My guidance is based to people says this is just a theory. It isn't customary international law yet, but they are working towards that end, and there are still the political forces out there that are still pushing against them. I think it was Belgium, for example, was very skeptical about it, and they had this nice little statement about it, and they made a little bit of noise about it, and it all came back down to that Article 2 interpretation about the silence of the Outer Space Treaty on resources, i.e., you know, basically that resources aren't part of a celestial body, and their question was, who gets to decide whether or not resources are part of a celestial body? I mean, who has the authority to say whether or not resources are part of a celestial body or are not part of a celestial body? So that's what they're kind of pushing back on a little bit right now. And that is the central nexus of this whole issue of space resources, how you interpret that Article 2.
So the companies, I'm sure, are going to keep pushing forward.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And making investment in this.
Yeah, absolutely. They're going to be investing a lot. They're going to be investing, you know, in this, and their people who actually, you know, created this are going to be out there promoting it, and they're going to, more and more countries are going to probably sign on to it and say, you know, they see this as a wave. I know you have UAE, you have Luxembourg, Japan's going to sign on to this. There's the U.S. obviously, maybe even China. There's been some rumblings about China's supposed commercial space law. They're interested in this concept as well. So it's definitely well on its way. Personally, I'm still skeptical about it. Something doesn't feel right about it, but I'm keeping an open mind about it, and we'll see how it plays out.
If Article 2 were literally enforced and private companies, the policy becomes out of the United Nations or overwhelmingly international, that companies don't have any usage rights, does that destroy the deep space mining industry before it even gets started?
I don't know, but at the same point, I think that the United States would use its leverage and its prestige to actually press forward and say, we're going to do this anyways, and we're going to make this custom.
A lot of people, you know, when you started out, we mentioned a lot of recent space show guests that have been on, and there are some, and not necessarily the ones who are on the show, but they post on the blogs and they sometimes call the show. But they talk about time to withdraw. Bob Zimmerman, for example, is a proponent of withdrawing from the Outer Space Treaty. Almost everyone I've talked to doesn't support that as a solution. What are your thoughts on withdrawing from the Outer Space Treaty?
I'd say it's going to be, it's probably going to be, if the decision was made at the executive level, and this is something the president would have to decide, and this would be, there would have to be an enormous amount of considerations. You know, how's this going to affect national security? How's this going to affect us geopolitically? How's this going to affect us economically? The Outer Space Treaty has been around for 50 years, and it's not something that's going to just be the decision isn't getting up in the morning, having coffee, saying, you know what, we're going to withdraw. There's a lot to take into consideration. So when people say, well, we need to withdraw from the Outer Space Treaty, while that might have some benefits, the question is, what kind of detriments are going to follow that? And in other words, there's going to be a lot of geopolitical backlash from that, and countries like China and Russia will definitely take advantage of it and create what we call soft power to, you know, beat on us pretty good about it, and you know, make us the bad guys. So these are all things that have to be taken into consideration. Now, that said, there is provision in the Outer Space Treaty to amend, and there's also a provision to withdraw. And withdrawal, the idea is once you announce withdrawal, it's a one-year process. You've got to give a year's notice, and within that year, you know, you basically gradually withdraw from the accord. One of the things I theorized, and I think I wrote about this in my last issue of the Pressy, a special issue I did that focused on it, was basically, you know, if it ever came down to withdrawal, during that 1 year, we could look at the Outer Space Treaty and say, you know what, we're looking at all these different areas, provisions in the Outer Space Treaty, and we'll pick out the ones that we're going to abide by and recognize as custom. In other words, legal precepts and principles that we have by state practice, we have adopted and abided by. And there is already an argument out there that the Outer Space Treaty has been abided by for so long that it is customary international law.
Well, that was my next question. Even if we withdrew, how much of it would be custom?
Yeah, I mean, a good chunk of it would be custom. And, you know, there are a lot of good things in there. The prohibition against nuclear weapons, the peaceful uses provision, and the idea that any space objects launched are basically flagged to the country that launched them. Planetary protection. I mean, I know there's some argument. I know there's some debates about the planetary protection aspects that may have to be looked at. But that's another good object there. I guess the biggest thing that really gets everybody is that race communist language, because it really does kind of tie your thumbs a little bit when you want to do things like mining. And here we have the workaround space resources, actually a workaround to get around that provision a little bit and do that. But if you want to get into things like homesteading, like Bob Zimmerman talked about with Homesteading Act, a Homesteading Act in space doesn't work unless you can actually get rid of that race communist principle, because homesteading deals with actual grant of land that you work and you convert to your own. In other words, you make it a usufruct that we talked about earlier.
Right.
So when people talk about, you know, withdrawing from the Outer Space Treaty, chances are, you know, they really got to stop and think what it really entails, and, you know, whether or not it'd be a good idea. I guess the biggest question that to be considered when a decision to withdraw is it, you know, is the Outer Space Treaty something that's really useful and will continue to be useful in the years and decades to come? Or have we abided by it for so long that it's actually become this geopolitical icon that we don't dare touch? So that's a tough question to ask, especially in a geopolitical environment. And while things may make sense in a legal sense, sometimes it doesn't make sense. It doesn't always transfer over to the political end of it.
My hunch is that if we look at the U.S. population only, and we look at the U.S. population across the board, the percentage of Americans that give a hoot about this is
right.
Probably, you know, if it's 2%, I'd be surprised. So your constituency that supports this, while vocal, and it does have advocacy in Congress, that's for sure, is
yeah.
really tiny when it comes up against other interests that the president and Congress need to attend to, like health care, like, you know, any number of things that are, you know, on people's mind. This thing just doesn't even probably rate to put it on the slow burn agenda for 10 months from now.
Yeah, so, I know. Senator Cruz had a hearing on his subcommittee, I think it was a couple weeks ago, and Robert Bigelow was on there, and they got into a big discussion about, you know, the Outer Space Treaty and how, you know, it's kind of holding back free enterprise and some possible ways of potentially amending it. Amendment, believe it or not, is a political hot potato too, because in the sense, are you going to have the political? Do you want to take the chance that an interpretation you're going to make through an amendment is actually going to benefit you in the long run? I mean, countries. I mean, I look to the things at the UN all the time, and you know, almost without fail, there's always a country that says we need to amend, you know, certain aspects of the Outer Space Treaty. But none of that comes from either the United States, Russia, or China. They don't want to touch it. They don't want to touch it because right now they're comfortable just being able to work their way around the loopholes in it and work and interpreting it to their benefit, which is basically one of the reasons, you know, they drafted the Outer Space Treaty as it was, and one of the policy considerations they made when they signed on to it. So I don't see amendment as an option either. What I do see versus an outright, you know, alternative to actually withdrawing, I see the Outer Space Treaty, and actually Rand Sundberg mentioned this to me a few weeks ago, and he made a very good point. Eventually, we're going to interpret it into irrelevancy. We're going to interpret it to our advantage to the point where its original meaning probably won't make any difference anyways. So it's one of those things that's going to stick around for a while. It's a Cold War. Definitely, in my opinion, it's a Cold War relic that was really designed to prevent, as Eisenhower saw it, as a Pearl Harbor in outer space. And I just think it's just too politically sensitive to go out and blatantly withdraw from. But in the long run, we'll probably try to interpret it into a point where it's really not where it's basically irrelevant, in my
okay.
opinion.
You got a caller, but real quick, if you amend it, is it a simple majority of the signatories that can vote to amend, or is it two-thirds, or what percentage of all the people that have signed it have to agree?
It's a majority. And depending on what the amendment is, you know, with all the nations, and there are over 100 nations that have ratified or acceded to it, it's going to be very depending on what the amendment is, it may be very difficult to get through.
All right, let me give you your caller. Hang on.
All right.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Kim.
Hey, Michael. I was thinking about the Europeans' approach to this, of the Lunar Village, and I wonder if there's merit to the idea that because they're trying to get a lot of countries involved that develop a base on the moon together, then everybody has a stake, and everybody is there to make the decision together about how we're going to proceed. And if you do it that way, then you can calm people's nerves and open up a document like that without there being such a sense of competition and need to block somebody else.
Well, I think the Outer Space Treaty definitely accounts for that. I mean, the Lunar Village, the way I see it, is basically government-sponsored in a sense. So it's going to be mostly a government project. So something like I think the closest analogy I can make are the bases in Antarctica. Each nation has their own bases in Antarctica. And the way the Outer Space Treaty is set up, you know, basically those installations would be open to anybody who may have, may decide to visit the moon. But the you're right. The concept of the village, of the moon village, is it's basically an international venture that would be government sponsored versus private. And I don't think you'd run into this issue of competition and free enterprise.
And does that create an environment that's conducive to renegotiating so that from there you can move into private enterprise? Do you think that's part of their angle?
I don't think the Moon Village would require renegotiation or anything in that respect. And I think it would basically, if it was ever established, it was saying, no, this is consistent with the Outer Space Treaty. We don't have to actually modify it. Where a renegotiation or an amendment may have to come in is, well, I know Bigelow Aerospace has been talking about, you know, putting modules on the moon, some of their inflatable modules on the moon, and their concern is they want control of not only the area where their modules are, but the surrounding area as well. And that's where we get into problems, because they basically want it for their exclusive use. And there are talks of, you know, you doing the lunar version of exclusion zones, economic exclusion zones, and whatnot. But the idea is it would be basically a private acquisition or a private occupation of certain areas of the moon. And that's kind of where things in the Outer Space Treaty are a little bit fuzzy and may require some amendment.
Okay. So I don't know if this is something that you get into. I don't know if you can. But from what you're saying, the thing that crosses my mind is then how do you approach the question of trying to create an environment that's conducive to everybody agreeing that we're going, this is how we're going to admit it, and this is how we're going to make it possible to do business in space?
Well, I think the problem is you're not going to get everybody to agree. There's going to be dissent, obviously. I mean, the idea is, like David mentioned, is in order to get an amendment of the Outer Space Treaty passed, you have to have a majority of the parties who are involved in the Outer Space Treaty voting to approve that amendment. And depending on what the amendment is, you may have a difficulty in actually getting that majority.
A simple majority.
So basically simple. I believe I'm not going to say simple, but definitely you need a majority of the parties who have a stake in the Outer Space Treaty to agree to the amendment. I don't have it sitting in front of me right now, so I don't see the exact language. I think it's Article 14 or 15. I think.
Michael, does a spacefaring country have a larger percentage vote than a non-spacefaring country?
No, my understanding of the way the amendment process works, everybody has one vote, one equal vote.
Okay.
But then, of course, there's the question of how people vote, and then there's the question of how people feel about it. And if people don't like it, no matter how they vote, there's ways to apply pressure. I just really wish there was a way to get everybody to the table and agree. Fantasy, but...
What world do you live in, Kim?
Well, bottom line is, you know, especially in the international arena, when you get into the international arena, here comes the cynic in me, basically. Especially at the international level, there's more at stake than the actual issue itself. There are agendas behind these issues. In other words, there is geopolitics. In other words, each country when they go in the UN, they go there in a spirit of cooperation, but they really have their best. But everybody has their own national interests at heart, and usually those national interests have agendas behind them. And just like, you know, in regular politics, sometimes they'll compromise in order to, you know, gain an advantage in another area, or basically vote against it or stonewall it in order to, if not so much because it's a bad idea, but because it's in their interest to maybe cause another country some problems. So that's kind of how, you know, that's kind of how politics and the geopolitical world work.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's simple, okay. But I mean, it's just basically that's kind of the way things work.
Oh, sure, sure. You know, and you're absolutely right. I just, you know, I have my own way of approaching things, but I think that it's sort of, for all space cadets, it's sort of sitting there, sort of hanging in the air of, there's got to be a way. And well, I guess there just isn't a way until there's money.
It's kind of funny. It's kind of funny because, you know, I'm kind of a Star Trek fan. I was watching the old Voyager series, and one of them, you know, Q's son is basically trapped on the starship in order to learn to be a good, quote, Q. Well, one of his first assignments was to go into a holographic situation where a bunch of diplomats who had varying interests, to get them to sit down and agree. And sure, he did it, except he cheated. He reprogrammed the diplomats to get everybody to be amenable to sit down talking to each other, and he did it that way. So he kind of cheated. So, unfortunately, you know, regrettably, we don't have that option here in the real world.
No, but you could maybe threaten them and cheat that way. So,
well,
you know,
I mean, you know, threats only go so far.
The space mafia loose on them. it's going to be interesting to watch all of this unfold over the coming years.
Well, I mean, I don't even know if this issue will be broached by this administration. And if it is, it probably won't be broached until if the current administration has a second term. Because there's just so much going on right now.
So years and years ago, there was a guy who I really liked. I know he's controversial, and he was a frequent guest on the Space Show. I considered him a true friend, but a lot of people hated him. They thought he was a real pig and a real, I don't know, whatever. But this is Jim Benson, and he passed away from cancer a number of years ago. But I remember in the very early years of the Space Show, so we're talking 15, 16 years ago, Jim and I would be at conferences together in New Mexico with this engineering group that is no longer around holding conferences. And Jim always made the statement that the wealthy will go out there and claim an asteroid and will start mining and will start making money and to hell with everybody and come stop us if you can. And that the legal issues would never be resolved until that process was underway and countries or people or groups felt that they were really being injured by what, say, Jim Benson and his company, which is called SpaceDev, were doing. And I have come to believe, with all other rhetoric and the legal posturing and the attorneys that I talk to and everything, that until someone does something similar to what Jim Benson described and actually goes out there to do the business and actually has the capability, rather robotically or with humans, it doesn't matter what, to do any of this, it's all going to be unresolved rhetoric. But once someone does it, and then you're going to see groups try to figure out how to stop him and how to support him, and that's when you'll see this maybe come in for some sort of compromise or resolution. I think Jim was 100% right 16 years ago.
And I think you're right. And I think this idea of space resource, the way it's being promoted, is kind of a step in that direction. Because, you know, the United States was basically, after they passed the law after it became law, they were like, you know what, we're going, you know, there's not, they went to a few conferences and basically the attitude was, we're going to do this. And everybody, a lot of people were screaming about
it. Come stop me. He says, come stop me. Jim thought he was going to do it within 5 years. He really thought he would have the money and the technology and the capability. And he just said, come on, come stop me. You come find a court of competent jurisdiction. You get your butt out there and stop me from doing this. And he was really kind of crass without foul language. He never used foul language. But he just said, stuck it in their face and said, come stop me if you can. This is what I'm going to do. You can't stop me.
And that's why I think space resources may have some merit, because when the point comes when they're actually ready to actually do this and they go out and actually harvest those resources, they're going to basically say, we've done it. A lot of people will start screaming about it possibly, but they're saying, well, you know what, we're going to push this and we're going to look at this as customary international law, practice.
And they're not really going to be able to stop it, so they might get some compromises as to how it works. But
I think ultimately it's not going to be agreement across the board, but it's going to be a lot of compromises that'll eventually seal it. Again, like I said, I do have my concerns about it, but I keep my mind open about it.
Kim, do you have anything else, or I'll free the line up for the time being?
Well, Well, I wanted to throw out one other idea. I certainly don't have a legal mind, but at conferences, I've talked to one or two people who made the point that their company, you know, the same sort of idea, they think that they have a great idea and they can make it work, and that they say that the rules are restricting them, they're tying their hands, but that they could go to a country that isn't part of the deal or has no stake in being part of the deal and launch from there. And if it became a possibility, what is the playing field there? How is pressure applied? What would happen to them? Is it within the realm of possibility?
No. Because I hear the Tonga thing all the time, and it always, the first thing, it's just an automatic response that my eyes roll when somebody tells me that, and I said, fine, you can try and go to Tonga, but if you're a U.S. citizen and they find out you're going to go and try and launch in a non-OST country, they're going to find a way to stop you. Whether, you know, they're not going to allow you to export the technology out, the necessary technology and equipment out there, or some other way, because even though, for example, you know, if a U.S. citizen were to go over to another country, say, I know New Zealand's going to be doing launches through Rocket Labs. Basically, you know, Rocket Labs is still an American, they're American citizens, and the FAA, which basically regulates commercial space, I shouldn't say that ugly word, regulate, has authority to authorize launches for United States citizens. Under Article 6 of the Outer Space Treaty, they have a long reach, and they can be basically looking over their shoulders as they're doing their things, even when they're abiding by New Zealand's laws, even though they're another country. So, and in fact, I did an interview with the Financial Times with a reporter about this and explained it to him. It kind of goes both ways. You know, if you're a citizen to another country and you go to one country and you go to another country, that doesn't mean your home country doesn't have authority or be able to look over your shoulder, because Article 6 gives them a long reach to continue to watch their activities.
Okay.
So the Tonga thing is irrelevant. I mean, there are a lot of ways they could stop it. They could stop them right at the docks or right at the airport before they try and ship technology over there, because with Tonga, you're going to have to import technology and materials in order to build that launch facility. And chances are they would be stopped if the government said, you know what, we don't like this idea. You're one of our citizens. We're going to stop you.
Yeah, the law also reaches U.S. hardware and technology, so it's not just a U.S. citizen. So a French citizen using U.S. launchers or hardware or software or technology would be subject to our launch laws too.
Yeah, and there's also ITAR, which is a huge boogeyman for people. This rocket engines are still, you know, on that list, you have to get a license from the State Department to export.
What else, Kim? Anything else?
No, that's everything.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're going to take a pause. We're at the halfway point. So for a change, we're going to pause pretty much on time. So we will be back with Michael in a couple of minutes. And more of your phone calls, hopefully, and I'll read some of your emails that have been coming in. 1-866-687-7223. And we're not limited to talking about property rights today, so if you have a question or a burning concern about something else, it's a free game with Michael as well. So give us that call. And everybody back in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of the Space Show. I'm your host, David Livingston, and our guest today is space attorney Michael Listener. We do have a couple of sponsor messages that I do want to tell you about. So do remember that Orbital ATK is one of our sponsors. They're known as a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies and the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And they are in the news. Michael has some information to share with us that includes Orbital ATK later in the program in DARPA. AIAA is a sponsor. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have 30,000 individual members. 88 countries are represented, 95 corporate members. They are busy shaping the future of aerospace every day and helping to advance the state of aerospace science and technology and engineering, increasing our knowledge of the universe and bringing the world closer together. So check them out at AIAA.org. And then, of course, we have Celestis, which is the premier space memorial service worldwide, and it has been that since 1995. And they are now partnering with CG Labs of Canada, which is a world leader of DNA collection and home storage for consumers. And Celestis is extending personal spaceflight options beyond memorial services to everyone living on the planet today. The new Celestis service stores DNA off-planet through Celestis lunar and deep space missions and provides you with a kit that you can use as well at home. And families that choose traditional burial can fly their deceased loved one's DNA on a Celestis mission. And then you can also include your own DNA from the living family members with that of your deceased loved one. And all of you can go to space together. And that's kind of a nice thing for a lot of people. If you want more information about this, visit Celestis.com, and you can get all the facts that you need to know. And remember, I am their customer, an extremely happy and satisfied customer with Celestis, in the name of full disclosure. And I personally recommend them if you want to send your DNA to space or you have a departed loved one that you want to memorialize by sending that person to space as well. So again, Celestis.com. So Michael, I forget who the guest was recently, but they said that Australia is starting up a space agency, and there's a lot of others. So this seems to be a global epidemic almost.
Well, I know there's been a push among academia and some in industry in Australia who want to see an Australian space agency. But more critically is that they are last year they started reviewing their current Space Act, and that was something they developed in 1998, and it basically does allow licensing for private companies to actually do missions. There has been, but they've been looking at the law again. They're doing a very thorough reexamination of the law, and they had a bunch of open comments, and they allowed input as to the issues with that they had companies were having with the law, or how can you say challenges with it. And I actually queried the agency if I could get a copy of that actual breakdown of what all the responses, and it was pretty interesting. And basically what it all boiled down to was the same issues of basically worries about regulation, worries about the procedure for getting licenses, concerns about the difficulty and about potential expensive insurance, and difficulty of licensing missions outside of Australia. A lot of these issues just ring true, and they're basically kind of same issues, that have been brought up, say, with the U.S. space laws, with other space laws in other domestic countries. So it's nothing new. Well, some of the issues they're coming up with are really the same issues that are being brought to the surface in their own version of a domestic space law. So the idea is they want to go back and either, A, modify this existing space law or start from scratch and write a new one. And I know there's been a bunch of people inputting. In fact, our friend Dr. Gorman, actually, she and her team are going to submit something to the Australian government as well on that end. So that is very hot there.
But what about other countries that, I mean, you know, you've got countries in the Middle East doing this, and you've got some sort of a New Zealand space law to accommodate rocket labs. You know, are you seeing anything in South America? I mean, we're seeing things in Australia and New Zealand and other countries in Europe and the Middle East. Where does Latin America come into this, or do they?
I haven't really heard anything in Latin America at this point, but several months ago, I mean, one time early last year, I was actually approached by somebody, from Colombia. They were inquiring about potentially consulting with them on space policy. I never heard anything back from them after that. I said I will consider it, and I never heard anything back from them afterwards. So I think they're all thinking about it, but I think they have, you know, in Latin America and stuff, they have just a plethora of other issues that are boiling over that need to be addressed before they actually start addressing space, which is kind of interesting because, you know, a lot of those countries rest right on the equator, and a bunch of them back in the 70s made a stink about, you know, owning geosynchronous orbit. It was called the Bogota Declaration. Right. And I won't go into that too much, but if you want to Google Bogota Declaration, that'll of 1976, that'll give you a whole scoop on that.
Well, they got blown out of the water on that.
So. Oh, yeah, they got blown out of the water on that. And during that period, the U.S. took the opportunity to say, you know what, we're going to interpret the Outer Space Treaty to mean it's going to be our position that the Outer Space Treaty allows, you know, commercial activities in outer space, in so many words, too. So we took the advantage of that, of blowing that out of the water to also, you know, push forward the agenda for commercial private space.
You mentioned Turkey is considering a space law. Where do they stand on something?
Turkey is forming a space agency, and that's been kind of off and on over the past year, but it looks like it's finally taking hold right now. It undoubtedly got slowed down a lot with the coup attempt that happened last year, but it appears their parliament is now starting to actually address that. I know Greece is considering it, is also considering a space law, and basically that would allow it would, or a space agency for that matter. Greece has a lot of issues right now, though, economically, too, so I'm sure that's not a hot priority, because I really haven't seen a lot more since they made that announcement last year. So that's another hot thing. I think I mentioned a couple weeks ago when I called into your show, the UK has actually drafted a domestic commercial space law, and my friend Chris Newman, he actually wrote a great piece for that for the last issue, quarterly issue of the Pressy. It was really good. And in fact, I'll give you the link to it. Spacewatch ME, whom I have a partnership with, to actually publish some materials from the Pressy, they actually picked that up and they published that on their site. So I can give you that link for your listeners to actually go and read that. It's an excellent piece by Chris Newman. I suggest you go over and Spacewatch ME and read it.
When I was at the Space Foundation meeting, I met this BBC reporter who's been on the space show a couple of times, and she didn't know about the UK space law and all of that. I was a little bit surprised about that. So I emailed her when I got back to my room the article out of the Pressy by Chris. I said, you know, he's in the UK. You ought to talk to him because this is probably something you would want to write about with your BBC journalism and stuff. And I didn't hear back from her, and I don't always get her article, so I don't know if she picked up on it or not. But she wasn't that aware of it, and I sent her Chris's piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he kind of jumped at the up. Chris has been a good friend, and he's really supportive of, you know, the work that I'm doing with the Pressy, and his analysis have been very welcome additions to the past two quarterly issues that I've done. So the whole domestic space law thing is taking off. I mean, even India is working on a piece of legislation right now. I don't have a copy of it, regrettably, because it's right now it's being reviewed by their Ministry of Defense. But they're working on that on their own, and basically it looks a lot like what the United States is doing. So really, the United States is kind of leading the way on a lot of this. The way we do commercial, not only the idea of commercial space, but the way we do commercial space, we're kind of setting the tone and the pace for how it's done.
You have an email from Jeffrey, who is in Portland, Oregon. And he says, you know, Michael, a lot of us even though we like space, believe that space should be a commons and not out there for every company to go try to make money and hoard commodities and do to space what they have done or tried to do in many areas of Earth's economy with Earth resources and such. Is there any support for the kind of view that I'm representing, and that space is truly a global commons and should not be touched by the commercial markets? Or is that just so insignificant that it doesn't get any attention anymore?
No, well, I mean, there are a lot of people who have that kind of view, and basically their view is that, you know, if there's actually going to be a exploitation like that of resources from asteroids or the moon, it needs to be actually overseen by an international government body, similar to the International Seabed Authority, which kind of sets up licensing for the exploration and exploitation of the bottom of the ocean, minerals from the bottom of the ocean. So, yeah, that view is out there, but again, it's, you know, you're going to have a lot of pressure from the other side saying, well, we need to go out there and start mining resources for whatever reason.
It's not a very popular view on the space show, although from time to time, Jeffrey, I do hear from people that do believe that space is a global commons and don't like the direction that the commercial space seems to be going. So I do hear from them from time to time.
Well, and that was kind of the whole, you know, one of the impetuses behind the Outer Space Treaty to begin with, that, you know, space is kind of a global commons. That's what race communism is about. It's a global commons. In other words, everything belongs to everybody. In fact, one of the big things one of the issues, and we're going to just touch that, I'm going to go back on the space resources for a moment, is, you know, they talk about, you know, compare it to fishing in the ocean. Well, you know, I come back and I say, well, that's nice, but when you go out in the ocean and you fish in the ocean, once you leave that spot, the fish will replenish themselves through natural processes. When you go to an asteroid and recover the resources, whether it's water, whether it's minerals, those don't get replaced. So they can't be, quote, used by somebody else. So that's kind of, you know, that's kind of an argument that I have against, you know, the idea of, you know, this idea of space resources.
So,
and it doesn't really allow the global, it doesn't allow everybody to take advantage of it.
Which is why they want to have benefit sharing.
Right. And that comes in with, that's kind of the philosophy of the Moon Agreement.
But people say the USSR or Russia and the U.S. never signed it, so to hell with it. We don't have to pay any attention to it. I know that's not your opinion on it, but
well, I mean, the U.S. believe it or not, the USSR was actually very positive for the Moon Agreement when it was being, you know, actually constructed. But then this whole concept being pushed to the common heritage of mankind, which is, I won't even start into discussion what's wrong with that, but basically that. Yeah, the insistence that be part of it from other nations, not necessarily the United States, that was distasteful enough for the Soviet Union at the time to say, you know what, we don't want any part of this. We're not going to sign it.
But it is a valid UN treaty. Do we have to honor it?
No, because we're not a party to it, and I don't think it hasn't reached the level of customary international law yet. So it really isn't, even though it's a treaty and it is technically international law, it really doesn't have that reach that, say, an accord like the Outer Space Treaty does, where it has hundreds of signatories or ratifications or accessions.
I have another caller for you on hold, but caller, hold on a minute. I'm going to read a very short email for Michael. I promise you it'll be short, and I bet Michael gives us a short answer. So Ted is in San Diego, and he says, the way I understand your arguments and the arguments of other space attorneys I have been fortunate to hear on the space show, my question to you, Michael, is if I was a young guy and I wanted to study space law, would it be more to my advantage to go to a U.S. law school or to go to a Canadian or international law school that saw these issues differently and more globally than the way Americans seem to see them? Where would I get the best law degree approach and knowledge that could help me with a career? I do want to practice in the United States, but I understand that U.S. may not prevail, and I don't know that U.S. law school really cover a lot of the international perspectives and decision-making processes.
Well, the short answer is your Juris Doctor, your fundamental law degree isn't going to get that in depth. Space law might be actually offered as an elective, but it's not going to be a full-on specialized course. That's what LLMs are for, and there are a couple schools in the U.S. that do it. Canada does it. There's one in the Netherlands that I know of that does it. I don't have an answer for you, and frankly, I'm not going to endorse. I don't want to recommend any school at the expense of, you know, potentially endorsing one over the other. But I think that's a gut feeling from you, and I think you got to do your research and find out where your feelings are. Bottom line, some schools are actually, you know, maybe more favorable to ideas like space resources because they may be involved in actually pushing the agenda, as opposed to other schools that may be not so behind it, may push a different philosophy. So I think you got to do your research, and I think you have to basically feel that out. But the fundamental thing is you got to get through your JD, your Juris Doctor first. And if you have the opportunity to take a class in international law, take it, because understanding international law is probably a big stretch because it takes a while. I've studied international law for years, and I still completely understand it. But to get that fundamental idea of the nuances, some of the nuances of international law, and then go into an LLM program. So get the JD first, worry about the LLM and space law later. Bottom line is worry about being a great lawyer and getting knowledge in a lot of areas versus, quote, being a space lawyer, because there's no such thing as a dedicated space lawyer in the sense that space lawyers are going to be fluent in contracts and in other areas of law. In fact, one of my colleagues put it nicely. He says, you need to go out and practice law and become the meanest, baddest attorney you can, and then decide to become, you know, and then get involved in space law, and you'll be really well equipped to handle it.
So the bottom line is if you practice in America, get your JD in America.
Yeah, I would definitely get your JD in America because if you're gonna practice in America, you're going to have to, you know, basically understand American law in whatever state you take your bar exam in. But if you want to specialize in something like space law or cyber law or air law, then you can pick an LLM at either a university here in the United States or a university abroad.
Okay, let's see who your caller is. Hi caller, welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, this is Al Millen from Rocky Top, Tennessee.
Okay. Al, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to first off say I'm not one that agrees with the 1979 Moon Agreement whatsoever, but Michael, you did write an interesting article a while back which puts forth some of the ideas that I'm trying to put forth to my spacefaring friends. It was called The Moon Treaty, It Isn't Dead Yet. I see it as a legitimate area of concern. The fact that it's in force, it's really not going anywhere. And if you look at its rate of growth over the past 10 years, it's been, you know, growing at a higher rate than it's ever grown.
I agree with you. I mean, it's still out there and valid. And really, take for example, in the Middle East, the UAE has decided to take the space resources approach. However, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait have ratified the Moon Treaty. They've decided to take the Moon Treaty approach to it. I guess
Turkey as well, right?
Yeah, and that I think, and I looked at them and said, you know, that's pretty significant because they have taken one side of they've taken the opposite side of the legal argument versus the UAE, which is looking to become kind of a central hub in the Middle East for this idea of space resources and space activities. Well, let me tell you the criticality of why it's important to watch the Moon Treaty. I mentioned earlier that, you know, Russia isn't too keen on this idea of space resources, and it's kind of pushing back a little bit. If Russia, when it came time to sign the Moon Treaty, basically balked at that common heritage of mankind language that I mentioned. But if they really wanted to get back at the U.S. and try and throw a monkey wrench into the works and slow things down, they could say, you know what? We don't like your space resources thing. We're going to become a signatory to the Moon Agreement. When you become a signatory to the Moon Agreement, it basically means you agree not to, you're not legally bound, but you also agree not to act contrary to it. Now, just that act of signature would be a huge geopolitical upheaval. I mean, it would definitely tip the scales more in the favor of the Moon Agreement and give it a little bit more legitimacy than it does right now, because there were three.
With the Russia concept, is it couldn't you say that Russia kind of is already on board by proxy, given the fact that Kazakhstan is on board with the Moon Treaty? So you could actually say that more launches take place under the jurisdiction of the Moon Treaty than anywhere else.
You know, because right now they're basically sovereign. They're their own sovereign nation right now. I mean, that could change maybe in the future, depending on how the geopolitical winds shift in that area of the country. But so Russia right now is kind of its own independent sovereign, independent of what its other former satellites do. But I mean, you know, bottom line is, you know, you got to keep, even though this Moon Agreement is not, you know, binding and has a lot of force, international force, like the Outer Space Treaty. If you get a country like Russia who decides, you know what, we're gonna sign this, or even more significant, we're going to ratify it and agree to be legally bound to it. That would definitely tip the scales stronger in the favor of the Moon Agreement and throw the monkey wrench into the space resources thing. It may not stop it, but it would definitely slow it down.
I've come. This is my last question. This is my main one. I've come across, maybe you've seen this too, an article. Actually, it was a paper submitted in 2009 at the COPUS Legal Subcommittee by what was then the Vice President of the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, which is a co-author of the Moon Treaty, and one of the guys that wrote the bulk of it. And this is why I take this seriously. It says, I pulled a couple quotes that I want to read off of this. And one thing it states that it says, this agreement was, however, from the very beginning, perceived as an objective legal regime to be valid for all states and not just the state's party to it. Mm-hmm. And then he reiterates that. He says, it was meant to constitute a legal regime to be respected not only by the state's parties, but by all members. Mm-hmm. Now, I've tried to get an answer from some official sources as to what that could mean, how any treaty at all could take such a universal jurisdiction approach, but I can't seem to find an answer as to where that comes from. So the last question, and I'm going to hang up and listen, is where do you think that concept is coming from? What kind of supranational card is in play here? And do you have any thoughts as to why one of the co-authors would make such a statement?
That's a complicated question, and basically I think that basically gets down into politics and geopolitics, saying they may have said that, but you know, a lot of countries like the United States probably sat back and say, yeah, okay, that's nice, but you know, we're still not going to actually be subject to it. Now, it's interesting because I think I listened to William White, who was a guest here on Friday, and he talked about the Deep Sea Minerals Act that Congress passed back in 2004, I believe it was, and he talked about how it grants rights to, you know, U.S. citizens to license certain areas of the ocean for exploration and mining. But one of the things, if you look at one of the sections of the Deep Sea Mining Act, is basically it anticipates the U.S. entering into either the U.N. Law of the Sea Agreement, as actually ratifying that, or some other treaty. In other words, the idea is the Deep Sea Mining Act is kind of a stopgap. But the idea, Congress always intended that some sort of international treaty would be signed and ratified to actually govern those resources. So basically, that, you know, in that sense, you know, basically, I think that might actually allude to what you're saying, is we've always understood that it's when it comes to, like, the law of the sea, we got to be kind of careful what steps we take, even though we pass these laws, because there could be international legal ramifications in the long run.
Do you think it might be? My only guess as to what the co-author of the Moon Treaty could have meant is this is just a random stab at it. But I guess if you look at Article 1 of the Moon Treaty, it designates the jurisdiction territorial scope as the solar system outside of Earth. Mm-hmm. Maybe once all five countries that needed to ratified it, then it was a treaty in force. So then there was often no jurisdictional bubble that you could either accede to or not. Could that be what he was talking about, and the fact that the territorial scope surrounds physically all the countries? Or I just don't see how a guy that is that familiar with supranational practice would how else you would justify saying that. Maybe there's something we don't know yet.
I'm not you know, thinking right now. I'm not sure exactly what he is, what he might have been getting at. Although I'm gonna probably end up chewing on this for the next couple of days until I come up with an answer in my head.
You can find the I'm gonna hang up and listen now. You can find the document is on the Copeland Legal Subcommittee's 2009 page. But I appreciate your knowledge of this and look forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you for
your call. For your call. Just as a corollary to that, I want to just. You know, when we talk about the Outer Space Treaty and the Moon Treaty and the Law of the Sea, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, the Outer Space Treaty does have children, and that's those four agreements, the Rescue Agreement, the Liability Convention, and the other two agreements. Those are the children of the Outer Space Treaty. Now, the Outer Space Treaty is actually a sister to the Antarctic Treaty. In other words, they were both kind of developed at the same time and both use the same concept of property. Now, the Moon Agreement is not really a sibling of the Outer Space Treaty. It's probably a kissing cousin. It's actually the Moon Agreement and the Law of the Sea are sibling treaties because they both have the same fundamental legal concept, res nullius versus res communis, that Antarctica and the Outer Space Treaty have. So your listeners understand that those two treaties, the Moon Treaty, Moon Agreement, and the Law of the Sea Agreement, are actually related to each other versus being related to the Outer Space Treaty.
Okay. It's going to be interesting to see if more and more countries do become part of the Moon Treaty, if it starts to carry more and more weight.
Well, you know, it's hard, you know, and it gets right down to that fundamental. You know, there are two legal positions being staked out right now as far as mining goes. It's the Moon Treaty, the ideas behind the Moon Treaty and the idea behind space resources, and they're polar opposites as far as positions go.
This kind of political challenge from different sides seems to be all over the place, doesn't it?
It's business as usual when you get right down to it.
Absolutely, but again, I'm sort of on the record here that I don't believe this is stoppable. It might get delayed, but I do think eventually some company is going to go out and do it, and they're going to say, come stop me. And that's going to be really hard to do.
I've always said once a company actually performs it, then the U.S. can come back and say, we recognize this as a customary international practice, a state practice, and we recognize it as customary international law.
Go ahead.
And then things will be pretty that'll firm things up significantly.
You have another caller. Caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is John in Fremont, California.
Hello there. How are you?
Hi, John.
Hi, Michael. Hey, I remembered a news story a couple of weeks back. I can't remember when, and I apologize, I haven't done the due diligence to look it up, but hopefully it'll jog your memory. Didn't Luxembourg government disallow one of their companies from resource rights for asteroid mining, and is that ringing a bell with you?
I don't think they actually disallowed it. They actually promoted a draft of their asteroid bill, which is very similar to what we did here in the U.S. Except they, in my opinion, they have done a lot more due diligence. Their legislators have been doing a lot more due diligence, and they actually came out with an opinion. And I'm looking at the opinion right now, but it's all in French, and regrettably I don't speak French, so I'm looking for a decent English translation so I can go through it. But basically, there's some concerns about whether or not they can actually grant these rights and whether or not the UN may have to become more involved, and there might be have to be some agreement within the UN as far as a regime to do this. There's a space resource working group that meets in The Hague, and they just met a few weeks ago, and they're actually working towards some sort of agreement, a fundamental structure of some sort of international regime to govern space resources that they'll present at the UN after it's done. Whether it be accepted or not is another thing. But yeah, I know what you're talking about, and they haven't necessarily disallowed the companies from doing it. In fact, the companies that are doing it are a lot of, most of them are the U.S. companies that are doing, are planning it here in the U.S. They've just decided to base off in Luxembourg as well. And there are many reasons for, you know, actually basing out of Luxembourg for tax reasons and such. So that in Luxembourg is kind of, you know, famous for being kind of a exchange for terrestrial minerals as well.
Yeah, I can't remember if it was Zimmerman or Rand Simberg that saw it as a good thing because it was movement towards amending the Outer Space Treaty.
Yeah, there's some concern. I've read the article. I really don't like commenting on news articles until I've actually read the opinion. Like I said, I have it printed out here. I'll have to find somebody getting it translated because I want to see what they say about it and then make my own judgments from it.
But Luxembourg said that they have authorized going to the UN to try to deal with this with the Outer Space Treaty somehow, and they're going to present for modification at the UN.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, then you know the U.S. can presumably jump on their side and support that amendment or whatever modification needs to be done, or they feel needs to be done. But I think a comment was made because it would come out of Luxembourg, it might be a lot more palatable internationally to do it that way versus the United States proposing the amendment. In other words, if the United States proposed the amendment, a lot of soft power would come in. People would say, a lot of rhetoric would come in. Oh, you know what? You're looking to Congress, but you're looking to make imperial claims over sections of outer space, and you're going to use your military to enforce it. Versus Luxembourg, which really doesn't have, you know, comparatively doesn't have that much of a standing military. And pretty much, you know, keeps to itself as far as international affairs goes. It might be more palatable proposing the amendment from there. So that sounds fundamentally like a very sound idea.
Anything else, John?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Listeners, our line is cleared. If you do want to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223. And email drspace, drspace at thespaceshow.com. Michael, we're probably down to the last half hour or so of the show if we do a 2-hour program. What are some of the other topics and issues? I know you wanted to talk about other things as well.
Yeah, I know. I would reiterate there's a lot of domestic legislation being proposed to. The NASA Authorization Act was 2000, was basically passed and signed into law. And I know Marcia last Sunday talked about some of the appropriations for that. But there's some other things in the works. Reasserting American leadership in space. It's called the REAL Act, introduced by Representative Bill Posey from Florida. And then there's a few other things that are going to be. And in fact, I think Representative Bridenstine is going to be reintroducing the American Space Renaissance Act in this year. Sometime this year for a reconsideration. So that's another thing to look for. And I know Senator Cruz talked about actually sponsoring a new Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act to amend the 215 law to maybe actually be proposed later on this year or introduced into Congress this year. So there's a lot of stuff going on domestically as well as foreign, too, in outer space legislation.
Is Trump going to issue his version of a new national space policy?
Not immediately. I'm looking at 2018, probably sometime in 2018, maybe 2019. It usually takes a couple of years to actually work through it. And, you know, I see people crying, crying foul in the forums about, you know, well, this is, you know, he has no space policy. I'm just like, you know what, give him a break, just hold your horses and let the administration decide what its position is going to be. People ask me, well, what's a space policy? I said, I don't know. I'm not on the inside, and even if I was on the inside, I wouldn't be talking to you about it. Bottom line is, we're going to have to be patient to find out what he actually creates and what gets released in the public version of his national space policy.
We don't even have a NASA administrator yet. Is that crucial for a space policy?
I don't think that's crucial for a space policy. But, you know, the fact that we don't have one yet isn't a big deal because I think when the last administration, it was well into June or July until we actually, you know, nominated and had one actually confirmed. So we're kind of, you know, we're actually in the works. And, of course, we know of one person who is in consideration for that job as well. And we've had that discussion before offline.
It is widely known, and he did give a talk again this year
at the Space Foundation. What I'd like to know is who else is talked about or rumored to be what the hell was that? I guess there's some kind of a pop. Who else is in that discussion to possibly, you know, be a NASA administrator? The only one I ever hear about is Bridenstine, but I'm imagining there are others there too.
Well, I'm sure there's others, but he's definitely a high-profile figure right now with everything that he's been doing in the space area. I mean, he's been extremely active in space-related matters, and he's definitely an area of interest for him. And he's definitely been making some waves and making his mark in that particular area.
Well, for sure, I did meet the acting administrator when I was doing my panel at the Space Foundation, Robert Lightfoot, and I would imagine he could carry on and be very, very good for a long, long time. He could probably be the director. He could probably even be the new administrator.
And that's, you know, and that is a very good possibility if Representative Brunstein either decides not to nominate him, or he decides not to actually accept the nomination. I mean, if he was actually offered the job and Congress confirmed it, I don't see him turning it down, but you never know.
You never know about these things. That is for sure. Do you see any other efforts, I guess, to say consolidate NASA, maybe trim it? You know, there's always talk about we've got too many NASA centers. Do you see anything like that coming up in the new administration?
I'm sure that's going to be a big focus because, you know, this administration, well, it runs from almost the president is a businessman. He definitely looks at excess, and he doesn't like waste. So I'm sure that'll come up again, and that'll be very politically charged because, you know, definitely it affects the constituency of some people in Congress, and they do have a big say in what money gets spent and what money and how that money gets spent too.
But they do close military bases from time to time, so
yeah.
I'm assuming they could close
actually. And believe it or not, that there's been talk about that too, about a new round of base closings as well. And the military has basically said, and some people in the military have said, you know what, we have too many bases, we need to consolidate. But the only reason we've been keeping them open is because of political pressure.
Well, yeah, the payroll that they generate for an economic area is huge.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's
exactly
a big impact if you close a base.
Exactly. I know the feeling. I mean, that happened here about a few decades ago, and it was a huge impact.
Linda's in Boston, and her email is, are we headed back to the moon with President Trump? Will we actually see a policy about this?
I don't know. We'll have to find out when that national space policy comes out. Right now I'm hearing a lot of talk, but talk is cheap until I actually see something in an actual policy. It's a possibility. I'm sure it's something he's been considering and is being advised on. We will see, you know, what direction that takes when his national space policy comes out.
I have another question. This one's weird. I'm going to ask it to you anyway.
All right.
Will is in Atlanta, and he says, forgive my being possibly politically incorrect, but we heard President Trump emotionally claim that he was motivated to fire tomahawks on Syria when he saw pictures of Syrian people gassed, including children. So what is going to happen if on President Trump's watch he sees a commercial spacecraft blow up or crash, killing or injuring crew members or people on the ground? Is he going to be so emotionally charged that he kills all commercial space or human spaceflight programs? If he is that impressionable without getting all the facts before launching missiles, what might he do with a commercial space accident involving the loss of life?
Well, I don't think you have anything to worry about, because I think he has a lot of people. I think, you know, contrary to what is politically, you know, the political rhetoric out there, I think this president, you know, surrounds himself with advisors who have different points of view, and he listens to what each has to say, and goes in with a plan. I mean, the whole, I'm not going to belabor the Syria thing, but I don't think the Syria thing was, you know what, they killed a bunch of kids, I'm going to go order the missiles. I'm sure he had advisors basically giving him a range of options to do, and, you know, to do. And I think the same thing, if and when there's an accident or incident like that, I'm sure the first thing he's going to do is, you know, well, he might get on Twitter and make some unfortunate tweets. That's always a possibility. But I think he'll talk to his advisors about what the next step should be. I'd be more concerned about what happens in Congress versus what the president will actually do.
Okay, another email for you. Bill is in Dallas, Texas, and he says, Simberg did a Hotel Mars segment with Livingston, and while it has not been archived yet, I do know that he was asked a question, and this is a longstanding Simberg perspective, about the asteroid redirect, and did he think moving an asteroid closer to Earth would benefit space mining. And Simberg said it would, and one of the reasons why he thought it would is because he defines a celestial body under the outer space tree as being in a natural orbit. And if NASA or somebody moved an asteroid closer to the moon or Earth, it would no longer be a celestial body because it would no longer be in its natural orbit, and therefore it could be appropriated, mined, and developed and everything, and would be outside the reach of the Outer Space Treaty. Do you agree with the Simberg legal analysis?
Actually, Rand made an accurate statement. I know what he's talking about. I've actually discussed it myself, but it's not so much what I've said. It's what other groups have actually proposed, you know, before that. You know, they have actually defined the legal definition of celestial body as one that, when a body outside of the Earth's atmosphere, that it's in its own natural orbit. So it's one of the theories that's been out there, and one that I really kind of promoted, was if you can move that, if you have enough. A spacecraft that has enough delta V that can just alter that asteroid's natural orbit and put it into an orbit you desire, that technically, and this is splitting hairs big time, it's no longer a celestial body, and it's fair game. The U.S. could plant a flag on it, or a company could go up there and own it, theoretically. I mean, it would cause a huge uproar. I mean, I'm just sitting here laughing in my mind at kind of the uproar that it would cause, but yeah, Rand makes an interesting point from a legal theoretical standpoint. That's he is correct. Whether that would play out in real life in practical terms, well, that's another question. But I do agree with him on that. That was one reason that I liked the asteroid redirect mission, is because it would definitely open up that can of worms, and it would be interesting to see how it played out.
Boy, the global commons people would have a freak attack.
It would be a huge to do, because when you look at it, there's a lot of asteroids up there, and if they're small enough mass, you could probably alter their orbit. Probably could generate enough, you know, thrust to get that delta V to move it out of that natural orbit. But you couldn't do that to a planet or to the moon, and those would remain that category of celestial bodies. I mean, it would be legal and geopolitical splitting hairs, and it would definitely cause an uproar. But it would be interesting to see what the effect of it would be.
So if you moved it, what kind of liability would exist if moving it down the road caused some damage or
that's the other issue. I mean, if moving it, say you moved an asteroid and you moved it closer to Earth, and eventually you screwed up, you screwed up in your calculations, and it impacted the Earth, and it hit another foreign country, for example. Well, we have serious liability under the current international law. So those are things you have to take in consideration too. And you'd probably have a hard time finding an insurance company to underwrite you for any indemnification you'd have to pay the U.S. government for any damage caused by, say, an asteroid strike.
But Bill correctly explained the Simberg position, right?
Yeah. See, I don't know how. Like I said, I haven't listened to it because it hasn't been posted yet. But fundamentally, what Rand said is theoretically correct.
So that I was not aware of that, but that's toward the end of the Hotel Mars segment, and hopefully it'll get posted tonight or tomorrow, and I'll get it up on the Space Show website as soon as possible too. But it wasn't there as of last night. So are any deep space mining companies seriously talking now about moving a small asteroid in order to plant the flag on it?
I don't know. I'm not too much in the loop on what they're doing, but I think they're putting all their eggs, all their legal eggs into the space resources basket and moving in that direction versus, you know, moving a celestial body, making a celestial body not a celestial body. I think that is, I think, a fundamentally sound course to take, but I think most of them are investing their legal future and the existence of their companies in the space resources theory.
Interesting. Listeners, just a note to tell you, we still have time if you would like to call or email us. So email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can phone Michael at 1-866-687-7223. I know you talked about a very interesting legal case. Of course, everything with you is legal. Before the show started, with DARPA and Orbital ATK. So update us on that.
Yeah, this all stems from a program that DARPA is creating called, the project's called RestoreL. I think it's called RestoreL. I'm not sure. But it's basically a project that DARPA was investigating that involves satellite servicing. And initially, DARPA was going to open this up to different companies to bid on actually building a spacecraft to actually host this experiment on. And then DARPA changes its mind and says, you know what, we're just going to sole source it out to, I believe, Laurel SSL, which is a Canadian company, as a matter of fact. And Orbital AT got a little upset about that. And, you know, they have their own idea, their own project with satellite servicing in the works. And they got upset that, you know, DARPA went and did this, and basically they're saying, okay, you know what, you have an obligation under the national space policy to open this up to, you know, to competitive bids and commercial bids, and you know, this is definitely a commercial project, and we should have had an opportunity to actually come out there and, you know, made a pitch for it to actually, you know, gaining this project. The idea is after DARPA does experiments, so this is going to be, I believe it's going to be a hosted payload on a spacecraft built by this company, and after they're done with their experiments, they're just going to hand over the technology and the rights to the technology to this company. And so basically what Orbital did was they filed a lawsuit against DARPA, and they said they're violating the National Space Policy of 2010. And actually the National Space Policy, when you look at it, is technically basically a executive order. And I think I'm looking at the number here. It's actually Presidential Policy Directive 2, I believe. I think that's it. Yeah, it's a PPD from the Obama administration. Actually, NSPD 31 or something like that. But anyways, it's an actual executive order. It's basically deals with national security. And what Orbital's contention is, you know what, this is binding law, this has the force of law, and by not allowing, a commercial company like Orbital to get involved in it, DARPA is basically violating the national space policy, in other words, violating the law. DARPA and the DOJ, obviously, they represent any civil suits that involve government agencies. The DOJ and DARPA filed their motion to dismiss a few weeks ago, and they came back. They came back extremely strongly and said, "No, that particular one, the National Space Policy doesn't have the effect of a statute. Oh, and by the way, there are these other statutes passed by Congress that basically tell us that we can do what we did." So, one of the big issues that's going to come up in this suit is whether or not the National Space Policy has the force of, say, a federal statute or federal law. And really, depending on how the court answers that, it could really open up a huge can of worms. So let me give you an example. If NASA is doing a project and it's keeping it in house, and it's going to actually, you know, it's going to do this as a government agency and not put it out to the commercial sector. And a company comes along and says, you know what, I think I could do that better. They should be putting that out there. Since the court decided that they have to follow the law of the National Space Policy, which, by the way, the 2010 National Space Policy is still in effect. It hasn't been superseded yet, as far as I know. Sections of it may have been superseded, but as far as we know, that one is still in effect. Basically, they can say, you know what, they're violating the provisions of, you know, basically encouraging, basically looking for opportunities to actually put out their duties into the commercial market, and we're going to bring them to court, and we're going to sue them on that basis. That could open up a huge can of worms, but with a bunch of companies that decide that they can do things better than a government project and really cause a mess. So the decision, one of the questions for the court is the National Space Policy, does it have the force of executive law, and are federal agencies bound to abide by it? Huge question. I'm waiting to see what the reply from Orbital ATK is on that motion. And actually, you know, DARPA and DOJ went whole hog on this thing when they did that motion to dismiss. They actually went to the executive branch and actually went to the actual National Space Policy, the one that wasn't put out in the public. And basically what they did is back in June, on April 7th, for example, they actually declassified portions of the actual National Space Policy. And what they did, the DOJ actually took that and added it as an exhibit to their motion to dismiss, because this is a space policy that Orbital is saying that basically has the force of law. So it's very interesting, because I actually printed out that portion, and you can see, you know, it's no longer secret, but there are portions of it that are still blacked out that will probably remain blacked out for many years to come.
Your best guess on this, what happens?
Oh, boy. You know what? I don't know. I think fundamentally the court's going to say, no, it doesn't have the force of law to tell them exactly, you know, to basically tell them, you know, you must do this. But it's more that it's more or less a directive. On the other hand, this is a special class of executive orders that in a sense does deal with national security. So to that extent, it may have a force of law, since national security is the purview of the executive branch. I think the court's going to wrestle with this, but I think that may be the DOJ and DARPA made a compelling argument that it's not binding. Those certain provisions with commercial space aren't binding on DARPA or any other federal agency, and doesn't have the force of law. In that case, Orbital ATK will probably lose its case. They'll probably win. DOJ will win the motion to dismiss, and the suit will go. Whether it gets appealed or not remains to be seen. For probably a few months before anything like that happens, though.
So, if it got appealed, would the fact that the court now has a conservative slant to it make a difference?
I have no idea. I mean, at this point, it would probably go through one of the Virginia appellate courts, because this is in the Eastern District of Virginia, and basically it's hard to say. I don't think this thing isn't too politically charged, like say an immigration order or such. It's very, very nuanced and very politically neutral. So I think a lot of this would be judged on the merits. Will be judged more on the merits of the law, and there won't be a lot of focus on political ideology.
Aside from Orbital ATK, are you expecting any friends of the court petitions or support documents, one way or the other?
I don't know. There might be some companies who might want to dip their toe in the water, but I think my guess is a lot of them are going to just sit by and watch and see what happens.
Michael, we're down to 10 minutes or so if we do a two-hour show. What else should we know? Because you haven't been on the program for a while, so there's been a lot
right.
of stuff, sort of mounting up. What else should we know about, and what do you see? I can't believe I'm going to say this, but, we're almost 6 months into the year. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yep.
And it's unbelievable for me to say, what do you see for the second half of the year?
I see a lot of focus on space situational awareness, specifically with basically transferring the function of from the Air Force over to a government agency like the FAA or such, getting that off their shoulders. It's really becoming a hot issue right now because space debris is actually the topic is actually heating up. I was talking to somebody a few days ago when I was down in D.C., and, you know, there's been a lot of activity in relating to space debris, and there's been some concerns about it. So I definitely keep an eye on space situational awareness, as there will be a lot of discussion about that probably within the next 6 months. You know what? You could probably even see something actually, some actual legislation maybe pop up by the end of the year, too.
Let me interrupt you for a quick second on that. There was more than one, but there was one major commercial company at the Space Foundation with an amazing booth of their software for commercial space situational awareness. And this is a really big issue because they want to be able to take over and sell their program and their management for space situational awareness to commercial companies. And be a purveyor of this service, and I'm trying to get them on the space show, and the guy who is my contact has been out of the pocket for a couple of weeks, so I'm going to try him again this coming week. But I may have a program coming up on this, because this is a big topic, and we looked at their commercial software. Dr. Eligar Sade was with me, and how they were doing it, and the case that they were making, and I don't want to say the name of the company yet, but this is a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a huge deal. And like I said, the space debris environment is starting to get there is starting to be some concern from what I hear from some of my contacts, and I won't go into specifics, but you know this is an issue that's really paying a lot of attention, and you know the fact that you know this is so this idea of reporting potential conjunctions is really taking a lot of resources away from Joint Space Operations Center and the groups that do it within the Air Force, within U.S. STRATCOM. My understanding is they want to transfer it over to another agency or a private company and let them, you know, handle these conjunction reports because, you know, it when they're doing this, they're not charging anything for it. They're basically, they're basically using their manpower to focus on that versus other parts of their mission as well. So it's not only, you know, the civilians that want to get, you know, the civilian aspect or commercial section. The military actually wants to get out of the business of actually having to do these conjunction reports.
What else should we be looking for?
I would definitely, I would keep, like I said, I'll just go back to the DARPA thing. Definitely keep an eye on that because that is a big thing. The X-37 landed this morning, X-37B. It landed after 700 days in Florida, which surprised everybody because the Air Force didn't give any hints that they'd be bringing it back today. So expect that'll generate some stir up some articles and some discussion about, what's this mission? Is this a space weapon? Are we militarizing space? That's always a huge thing, but this will definitely stir that up for probably the next few weeks or month or so. So keep an eye on that. There will always be talk about, you know, weaponization of space and such, especially at global governments, you know, when it comes in terms of global governance, you know, how we should be addressing that. That's another huge thing to watch. But I would say just keep an eye on the commercial sector, keep an eye on Congress for what they're doing with legislation. Like I said, Senator Cruz had an interesting hearing back about a week and a half ago, and I'm sure. And I was talking to somebody down in D.C. We were talking about the Outer Space Treaty, and they said, well, you know, if you think, you know, Senator Cruz has some interesting ideas about the Outer Space Treaty and such, so you know, hang on. I'm sure he'll be having more hearings as times move on. Maybe he'll have some, you know, people who are actually legal, you know, some legal people in there as witnesses to help, you know, kind of navigate through the issues.
Do you see space remaining somewhat bipartisan, or do you see it taking on more and more of the partisan fighting that we see in the rest of Congress and issues?
Well, I think both sides understand, you know, this is important. I think where you get the divide is about where when it comes to regulation. I mean, the, you know, Republican, you know, right now the tenor with with the House Science, Space and Commerce Committee is basically a very libertarian free enterprise view, and the same thing, that's kind of Senator Cruz's attitude too, you know, very, very little regulation. The Democrats tend to be a little bit more, you know, we need to regulate things, you know, and we need to be able to, you know, we got to be right on top of this. And when I talk about regulation, I talk about prescriptive regulations. In other words, regulations that say thou shalt not do this or thou shalt do that, versus performance-based, where you have actual metrics to actually, you know, basically put goals for these companies to, or standards for these companies to meet. So right now, the Democrats don't have the majority on either of these committees. But they'll definitely make some noise about it, and as you know, time goes on. And if they ever gain a majority in either House or both, I mean, that, it'll definitely be on the front burner again, and you know, that'll have to be taken up.
Use the remaining couple of minutes to tell us about the Pressies again.
Well, the Pressie, I can't believe it. I've actually published my 13th issue a couple weeks ago. It was a special issue. I've done, I think, four or five quarterly issues right now, and it's, you know, everybody who's subscribed to it has been very enthusiastic about it. They like the work, they like the analysis, and I'm just looking to grow the subscription to it. I'll just make a plug for it. I know for an individual license, I ask $199 a year, and you know, and people say, well, you know, that's a bit steep. And I said, well, if you understood the amount of work and time that I put into this and the level of gathering information that goes into it, you'd understand that. I've actually set it up on my website on the payment part for an individual membership. If they don't want to pay the $199 up front for a year license, and a year gets you four quarterly issues plus all the special issues in between, and that could be up to, you know, two a month in some cases, or even more. You can pay. If you use PayPal, I have a quarterly payment option where if you subscribe for a year, if you subscribe, you'll be billed around $49 in every 3 months or so throughout your subscription. So that kind of takes a little bit of a bite off the initial, you know, getting actually subscribed. So that offer is not, that's an option on my website to actually subscribe. If you go to my page for the Pressie, there's a link. If you want to click on it, you can request a free issue, and I'll gladly send you a quarterly issue to look at, and from a past issue as well as a special issue to give you a look at some of the topics I cover. I have subscription coming out of my ears, but my subscribers that I have are very loyal. In fact, one of my first subscribers who took advantage of that special rate that I offered for the Space Show back last year, I think it was in August, you know, he and I got into a conversation. He said, you've got to make sure and tell me when you got to make sure and tell me when my subscription is going to be ending, so I can renew, so I don't miss anything. So that was, and coming from the, and I won't say who the person was, but coming from the person that said it, that was a huge, immense compliment, and I don't take those types of compliments lightly.
Listeners, I can tell you that I've read every issue that Michael has put out, and it is very well done, and it's referenced in footnote. Hey, you know, if half of you guys out there posting blog articles with your opinions that you want us to accept at face value, if you even listed one reference to support the nonsense that you post, it would be a miracle. But Michael lists multiple references and citations for what he posts. You can bank on it even if you disagree with it, because he documents it. And this is one of the few things in the space world that I have seen where opinions and analysis are actually backed up and referenced. And many times what he says legally is an opinion. I mean, you don't know if it's binding unless it gets adjudicated in court and the judges say, this is it, like it or not, this is it. But so it's an opinion, but he backs it up. And as I said, you know, God, I wish you guys out there posting opinions on various space blogs, including ours, would even list one reference to back up your claims. But you don't do that, but yet you want us to take your opinions as fact and as being credible without any substantive referencing behind it. Not true with what Michael does, which makes it a very special and valuable document, in my opinion. And you do a great job, Michael.
Well, thank you. And depending on who wants to subscribe, I basically offer discounts. For example, if you're a member of the military or a government employee or retired from the military or government, I offer 25% off for a year subscription, which a lot of my subscribers have actually jumped on. If you work for a nonprofit, I actually, give you, I think it's a 10 or 15% discount on a yearly subscription from the individual price. And if you're a member of the media, you can always email me and I will talk to you about, getting you a media rate as well, which I won't tell you what it is, but it is very generous, considering the amount of content. I'm proud of the work that I'm doing with the Pressy, to the extent that I'm not cocky about it, because I've always said, just like the last special issue I did on the outer space, about withdrawing from the outer space treaty, when I was writing that, I was, I had some opinions about it, but by the time I got done writing it, some of my opinions changed. I said, when I really thought about it. So it's not only designed to make you think, it's designed to make me think too. So this is kind of an exercise of that. When I'm doing this, I don't have everything figured out. I'm actually, a lot of this time, I'm figuring it out as I actually write it. And like one of my subscribers told me one time, says, what I really like about this is you don't tell me this is the way it is. You actually make me think about, some of these issues and actually form my own opinions as well. And that's success in my opinion.
Yeah, and you back that up with references that people can check.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So I mean, I always tell people, people say you're an expert and everything. Well, maybe so, but the bottom line is when you're quote an expert in something, you always got to reserve the right to potentially be wrong about something, and always reserve the right to change your mind, because if you're not changing your mind, if you don't allow yourself to. Potential of being wrong, or allow yourself the ability to change your opinion, you're just being arrogant and you're not really being an expert, in my opinion.
Michael, anything else we should know about before we close it down for the day?
Nope, things are going, keep an eye on the, don't only keep an eye on the skies, but keep an eye on what's going on with the government. I always put a plug out to Space News because they do a great job. Marsha's blog, Space Policy Online, is a good place to watch too. In fact, sometimes for my work in the Pressy, I will actually reference some of her work and give her a link back because she does a phenomenal job kind of encapsulating what's going on in D.C. And, of course, the Space Review, Jeff Faust's publication, is always a good thing to keep up on what's going on there. Articles of varying subject matter. I contribute to it occasionally, but there's definitely it gives you a good idea what some of the thoughts are out there in the world of outer space law and policy.
Okay, well, listeners, that's it today for Michael Listeners. So stay tuned for tomorrow. Dr. Mary Lynn Dittmar is on, and we're going to talk about deep space exploration. And Patrick Collins, who was the first ever guest on the Space Show, is back with us from Japan on space tourism and related topics. There is no show next Sunday due to Mother's Day. I usually don't do programs on Mother's and Father's Day. So spend the time with your mom if you can, and with your family and friends. But then there is a program on Friday morning, and Hotel Mars is taking shape, but check the upcoming show menu for details on that later in the week. So everybody have a great rest of the weekend. May the San Francisco Giants actually win a game, or I should say not be slaughtered in the score for a change. That would work too. And special thanks to Michael Listener for being with us, to all of you who called us and emailed us. Good night from Michael, goodbye from David, and the Space Show. And everybody have a great rest of the weekend, a great week, and keep looking up.